So I thought I would continue reading from the biography of Meiji Gao. I'm going to read two different parts. The first part is just a short section in one of the later chapters of the book after her experience of awakening that describes her teaching style, some of the realities of her teaching style. And then the second part, I'll just go to the back where the author Ajahn Dick has collected some of her teachings, and I'll just read through them. The second part with the teachings, I'll probably just have a few moments of break between each one because they're anywhere from one sentence to a paragraph, not rarely longer than that. Okay, so first part. Meiji Gao had spent nearly 2 years in virtual seclusion within the nunnery, striving for liberation with a single-minded intensity. Now she shed her self-isolation to become more intimately involved with the day-to-day matters of her monastic community. She wanted to ensure as best as she could that each of her spiritual companions had the best opportunity to realize her full potential. She was, however, somewhat handicapped in her teaching skills. Meiji Gao, the person, was essentially a simple, uneducated countrywoman who had never been very eloquent or articulate when expressing her ideas. Being a karmic legacy of her transient personality, this deeply ingrained aspect of her character did not change. She was only comfortable when speaking in the local Putai dialect, voicing her remarks in the plain and earthy language of rural folk. Rhetorical skill was a gift that she had never possessed. For that reason, her teachings tended to be brief, direct, and simple, succinct explanations that cut straight to the heart of the matter, leaving much of the broader implications to the listener's own deduction. While Meiji Gao knew intuitively the fundamental moral bias of each person's heart and the advice that each needed to hear, she was hampered in articulating that guidance in a lengthy discourse by an inability to elaborate and expand verbally on her mind's conceptual formations. To Meiji Gao's clear and penetrating wisdom, those who really knew the truth remained silent, while those who talked often about the truth, in fact, knew very little. So now I'll go to the back of the book. Being born into this world, you must rely on your innate wisdom. You can seek pain or pleasure, seek things of value or things of no value at all. Depending on the direction you choose, you can find heaven or hell, or the paths and fruitions leading to nibbana. You can find anything. It's up to you to decide. The goodness of others is their own. We cannot share the fruits of their actions, so we must do good deeds ourselves. Do not doubt the efficacy of karma or underestimate the consequences of your actions. As human beings, we should feel compassion for the suffering of all living beings because we all experience suffering as a result of our past deeds. In this regard, everyone is equal. What differentiates us as good or bad, coarse or refined, is the kind of actions that we have done in the past. You can't grow enough grass by yourself to thatch every roof in town. Be generous within your own means. Don't go around boasting and bragging to the whole town. If something makes you look bad, you'll have to go hide like a frog that jumps down into the water as soon as it sees someone coming. If you're dumb, don't advertise yourself as clever. Those who fail to restrain their speech are unaware of whether they are right or wrong in what they say. Those who know the truth usually remain silent. Those who often talk of truth know very little about it. Be determined to keep watch over your bodily actions, speech, and mind, and conduct yourself with composure. Don't talk too much or create difficulties for yourself. Don't lose your self-control or be disrespectful to your elders. Watch your words and laugh with restraint. And no matter how close you are with someone, don't let your speech become careless. No matter how frustrated you are, don't let your speech become angry. And don't be crafty and sly, trying to fool people into thinking you're a good person when you're not. Someone who feigns virtue and intelligence is actually a dumb, silly fool who lacks moral goodness. Having been born into the world, we attach importance to the days and the months and the years as they pass. We believe in the importance of our lives and the lives of others. For this reason, our minds are constantly concerned with pain and suffering. No sooner do we take birth than we cling on tightly to our precarious state and start to worry. We are afraid of this and fear that. Our minds are immediately consumed by worldly influences and deluded tendencies driven by greed, hatred, and fear. We are born with this condition, and if we don't do something about it now, we will die still carrying those tendencies within us. What a shame. Suffering. Once we're born, that's all we have. Wanting, not wanting, being satisfied or dissatisfied, sitting, lying, eating, relieving ourselves, but there's no relief. Suffering is always there. So when we meditate, we should examine this heap of suffering in its entirety. We are never satisfied. We like to hear the sounds of birds singing, but then become annoyed when they get too noisy. People's hearts are so clogged up with pain and suffering, they cannot see anything clearly. By leaping after their desires and delighting in them, stupid people welcome suffering with open arms. They mistake suffering for happiness. Smart people look inside and examine themselves until they see what happiness truly is and what suffering truly is. Their hearts are not so easily blocked. When they see stubbornness in themselves, they recognize stubbornness. When they see gloom, they recognize gloom. When they see stupidity, they recognize that too. They look for their own faults. They don't try to fault other people. Moral virtue is founded in renunciation. True goodness is found in the heart. Look carefully at your own heart and mind. Examine them closely. There alone is where you'll find heaven and hell, the noble path leading to enlightenment and that which is secure, beyond all pain and suffering. Don't be resentful of criticism or prideful of praise. Simply stay focused on your meditation practice from dawn to dusk. Develop spiritual virtue day and night, and always speak the truth. Self-honesty is the basis of moral virtue. Know yourself, accept your faults, and work to overcome them. Hide nothing from yourself. Above all, don't lie to yourself. Lying to yourself is a fundamental breach of moral virtue. You can lie to the entire world if you like, but you must never lie to yourself. Cultivate your mind as a farmer cultivates his fields. Gradually clear the land, prepare the soil, plow the rows, sow the seeds, spread the manure, water the plants, and pull the weeds, and eventually you will reap a golden harvest. If you don't practice, you won't learn how to meditate. If you don't see the truth for yourself, you won't really understand its meaning. Don't remain idle, claiming that you're too cold in the morning, too hot in the afternoon, and too sleepy in the evening, and then complain you don't have time to practice meditation. Don't listen to the defiling tune of laziness and oppose the teaching of the wise. A timid person who only listens to himself is so busy groping for his pillow, he can never make progress along the path to enlightenment. Be determined to develop your mind by diligently practicing meditation. Dedicate your body and mind to the search for Dhamma. Use your heart as a torch to light the way. Be resolute on the path, and you will transcend suffering. As a human being, you should strive to be virtuous and never belittle the importance of Dhamma. Maintain moral virtue and meditate with diligence. It doesn't cost you a penny. Avoid being lazy. When calm and insight are fully developed, the mind will be far removed from defilement. Give up all attachments and transcend the world of suffering. The result is nibbana. Hurry up and establish a secure refuge within yourself. If you don't, when you die, your heart will have no firm basis to fall back on. Every living being, without exception, experiences birth and death. Each person who is born must die and be reborn again and again in a continuous cycle of suffering and hardship. People of every age group and social status are equal in this respect. Perhaps we'll die in the morning, perhaps in the evening, we don't know. But we can be certain that death will come when the time is ripe. Birth, aging, and death cycle on. Being descendants of the Lord Buddha, we mustn't live our lives only to rot and decompose without having found anything genuine within ourselves. When death comes, die properly. Die with purity. Die letting go of the body and mind, laying them down without attachment. Die in touch with the true nature of things. Die following the footsteps of the Lord Buddha. Die thus and become deathless. Listen to me. Don't just eat and sleep like a common animal. Make sure you remain disenchanted with worldly life and have a healthy fear of all future birth. Open your heart to true happiness. Don't just sit around idly, keeping vigil over the smoldering embers of your life. Knowledge about the world we live in may be useful, but no other knowledge compares with truly knowing yourself. The understanding arising through our physical eye is very different from that of our inner spiritual eye. The superficial understanding that we gain from thought and reflection is not the same as deep understanding born of insight into something's true nature. Someone once asked Ajahn Mun, "What books do forest meditation monks study?" His reply was, quote, "They study with eyes closed, but mind awake," end quote. As soon as I awaken in the morning, my eyes are bombarded by forms. So I investigate the contact between eye and form. My ears are struck by sounds, my nose by aromas, and my tongue by flavors. My body senses hot and cold, hard and soft, while my heart is assailed by thoughts and emotions. I investigate all these things constantly, and that way each of my sense faculties becomes a teacher, and I am learning Dhamma the whole day without a break. It's up to me which sense faculty I choose to focus on. As soon as I'm focused, I try to penetrate the truth of it. That's how Ajahn Mun taught me to meditate. The body is an important object of craving, and the resulting attachment is a tenacious defilement. Suffering is the consequence. To overcome it, focus your attention on the decay and disintegration of the human body, so that the mind becomes clearly disgusted with the human condition, thoroughly weary of the true nature of human embodiment. As repulsion to the physical grows stronger, lightness and brightness of mind become more prominent. The human body is a heap of flesh and blood, 2 feet wide and 6 feet long, that is changing every moment. Seeing the suffering caused by our attachment to the body is the initial insight that focuses our minds on Dhamma. Those who see the body clearly tend to understand the Dhamma quickly. When strange and unusual things occur in your meditation, just let them happen. Don't become attached to them. Such things are really an external focus and should be let go of. Put them down and move on. Don't hold on to them. All realms of consciousness originate from the mind. Heaven and hell originate from the mind. Pretas and devas, lay people, nuns, all living beings originate from the mind. Because of that, it is far better to focus exclusively on your own mind. There you will find the whole universe. In a perfectly still, crystal clear pool of water, we can see everything with clarity. The heart at complete rest is still. When the heart is still, wisdom appears easily, fluently. When wisdom flows, clear understanding follows. The world's impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial nature is seen in a flash of insight. And we become fed up with our attachment to this mass of suffering and loosen our grip. In that moment of coolness, the fires in our heart abate, while freedom from suffering arises naturally of its own accord. This transformation occurs because the original mind is, by its very nature, absolutely pure and unblemished. Purity is its normal state. It becomes blemished only because it accepts external intrusions, which themselves cause emotions like sadness and joy to arise and proliferate until the mind becomes totally blinded to its own true nature. In the end, it is inundated with the murky waters of the world, swimming crazily in its own pool of craving. Everything is created by our minds. The eyes see images, the ears hear sounds, the nose smells aromas, the tongue tastes flavors, the body feels sensations, and the heart experiences emotions. But the mind is aware of all these things. It knows them and it thinks about them, imagining them to be this or that. When our mindfulness and wisdom are strong, we can see these creations for ourselves. But mostly the defilements carry us along in their flow and the powerful natural momentum. Before we realize what has happened, we become angry, greedy, deluded, or conceited because we've been deceived by the defilements. So please watch the ebb and flow of those defiling influences carefully. Don't let them deceive you so readily. When we are skilled enough to keep up with their movements, we can transform their negative power into positive spiritual energy. Strive diligently and be patient. The pace of your progress depends largely on the store of virtuous tendencies you have accumulated from the past and on the amount of present moment effort you put into sitting and walking meditation. So always cultivate virtue and never let evil thoughts into your mind. The more you practice in this way, the clearer your presence of mind will become and the more comprehensive your understanding will be. As knowledge concerning your own true nature blossoms and blooms within your heart, the end of the long road of suffering will gradually come into view. But if you neglect to cultivate your inherent mindfulness and wisdom, striving half-heartedly, indifferent to the truth about yourself, the obstacles in your path will grow and multiply until they block all sight of the way, leaving the far end of the road forever in darkness. People say they want to go to Nibbana, so they crane their necks and look up into the vastness of space. They don't realize that no matter how far and hard they look, they still can't find Nibbana. It simply isn't within the realm of conventional reality. The practices that I have maintained all these years are not easy to do. They are extremely difficult. I have endured many hardships to test my determination and my stamina along the path. I have gone without food for many days. I refused to lie down to sleep for many nights. Endurance became the food to nourish my heart, and diligence became the pillow to rest my head. Try it for yourself. Test your resolve. You will soon discover the mysterious power of your own mind. Be a nun in the truest sense. You don't want to spoil your vocation by mingling with the foul-smelling grit of worldly life. So don't glance back, longing for your home and family. Avoid being a lazy nun who talks a lot and asks for favors. Always be satisfied with living a simple life, and never be afraid of death. Never talk about indecent matters. Instead, talk about matters of real substance. My nuns should always behave properly. If you truly wish to be my disciples, pay attention to what I say. When I complain about your behavior, understand that I am teaching you to always follow my example in whatever you do. You who have come here to be my students, make the effort to become exemplary human beings. Be a beautiful nun to her patient in your endurance of hardship and diligent in your practice of meditation, always striving to learn the truth about yourselves. My students should trust the way of the Lord Buddha, focusing intently on each forward step. Don't fret about lost opportunities of the past or anticipate future rewards. Such thoughts will only deceive you. Fight against any tendencies to laziness. Don't simply surrender to your pillow. Watch your mind carefully and search for the truth within your own heart. Before asking a question, look for the answer within yourself. If you search, often you will find the answer on your own. In the practice of Buddhism, you must find your own path. It is up to you to search for and discover the way to transcend suffering. The correct way to search is to look inside yourself. The path lies within the hearts and minds of each of us. So be tough and remain diligent until you reach the final destination. People suffer because they grasp and don't let go. They harbor evil intentions and ill will and won't let go. Suffering follows them everywhere. So you must examine yourself and learn how to let go. Don't doubt the value of meditation practice. Don't underestimate your abilities. Be content with whatever progress you make because it represents part of the truth of who you are. As such, it is something you can rely on. Consider who you really are. Who is it that is born, gets sick, grows old, and dies? Your body, your mind, your life, these don't belong to you. Don't soil your true nature with the sufferings of the world. Since the day I ordained as a nun, I have never quit cleansing my own heart of impurities. I am constantly aware that I need to polish and refine my basic nature. And the last one is, only the true sage can take refuge in the cool shade of the three Bodhi trees of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. That's it.
I have a question that might not... Well, I have a question. Is in terms of Bao Tanha and Li Bao Tanha, so Bao Tanha concerns both the desire to simply be, to exist, as well as to be a certain way?
Yeah, to be something, to be some way. Yes, the constellation of movement around the sense of self, in the sense of wanting to be something, wanting to, you know, have some recognition as a person, as a being, wanting to be good, wanting to get ahead, wanting to establish a solid sense of this is me, this is who I am, this is substantial, solid, so it's on a course to a subtle spectrum, but that's that sense of towards wanting to establish an identity, a sense of solidity.
On the flip side then, could you say Vibhava Tanha is like the thought, I am this way and I don't want to be this way, I don't like who I am, I don't want to be.
Yeah. I mean that, because it's sort of the pushing in the opposite direction. I don't like this, I don't want this, I shouldn't be like this. The world shouldn't be like this. Mm-hmm. So it's like that going toward something in terms of a state of being and then pushing it away or trying to get out of it, to annihilate it, to stop it from being.
It's interesting, this concept of the shadow. First it was either Freudian or Jungian concept.
I think it was Jungian.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously that's probably just lined up with the Achillesis. It's just interesting the various approaches both in the suttas and then from different teachers on how to relate to the Achillesis. And I don't know, just these different ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
In terms of, especially in terms of wanting not to be those things.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, obviously it's there has to be as soon as it's put in the context of impermanent, unsatisfactory non-self, then that sense of, because you know, obviously all the teachers are saying, yeah, you shouldn't be greedy, angry, deluded. I mean, it's not very helpful. But the context is one of, rather than it being vibhava-tanha, which is pushing away or trying to annihilate or setting up a negative sense of self, there's a recognition of the inconstant nature, the instability of it, and the it being fraught suffering. So then there's a motivation to relinquish and release. But also I think in terms of looking at it as you're sort of saying, your shadow, recognizing how a somewhat noble aspiration can have the source of dukkha within it, in the sense of, I shouldn't be angry, or I shouldn't be grief, but then its shadow is the sense of self that gets into that, or the sense, I should be a good meditator, I should be a virtuous being, but then the shadow is the becoming energy and the identification and awakening. So it has its own kind of I think what Meiji Gao does said quite nicely, and it's a theme that goes through pretty much all teachers in saying that a defilement there is, it can be transformed. It can be the seed for. So rather than it being a shadow, it's like the fertilizer that actually something good really can come out of that.
This is a question about my own practice. I seem to make a virtue of laziness, and I have gotten a lot of mileage out of it. And so when I hear the teaching of going without food and without sleep, I don't believe it, and have a hard time with those particular precepts myself. I wondered if you had some way to help me with that.
Well, I think it's in a similar way of relating to the, because there's something that we put a positive spin on, but what's its shadow? And in the end, one of the things that we always need to be checking with in our practice is, does it lead to an increase in wholesome mental states, in the sense of bright, positive, healthy, kind of clear, stable qualities of mind? And if that's the result, then that's in line with the Dhamma. But if there's, you know, the qualities of the mind not really very stable, not very clear, not really that sharp, not really that bright and happy or peaceful, then it's that's going in the opposite direction of the purpose of the Dhamma.
Could you say a little bit more about what you're talking about of seeding this unwholesomeness or this shadow?
What was that?
About seeding the unwholesomeness in what forms, at what levels? Could you give some examples of what you're saying?
Well, I mean, in the sense of, you know, we can have a, you know, what we think is a wholesome intention. Well, I've got to meditate more, and so then there's this, I've got to meditate more, and but then more, and how is that defined? And so we keep, we're never meditating enough, so we're never really actually paying attention to the present moment. We're looking to, how do I meditate more? And so we're never really peaceful, and we're agitated trying to meditate more. We're not actually very mindful of what we're doing because we're trying to meditate more. And it's all very, you know, couched in wholesome, you know, the idea, you know, it's a wonderful ideal. And we should meditate more. But it's, you know, we can torture ourselves doing it and not really be very happy or very peaceful with the efforts that we make. Or we can have a negative sense of, you know, we should be, you know, we shouldn't be. Yeah, we shouldn't be greedy. We shouldn't have any kind of greed. Shouldn't have. So then we start worrying about any kind of object that we pay attention to that we feel is actually pleasant. So anything pleasant that comes up, I shouldn't be greedy. No, I've got to push that away. So then I'm just really greedy. And all it is a pleasant sensation arising from contact. But because of our our mindset of that, you know, a real practitioner isn't greedy, they don't have any desire. So those are ways. Yeah.
This is a question that kind of relates. It's kind of been brewing in the back of my mind for a few weeks now. I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. From what you just said, the view that greed shouldn't be coming up in the mind, from a number of the talks, there's been this sort of there can be this sort of view that the enlightened mind doesn't have any sort of thoughts or defilements. It's just perfectly clear and stable, and there's kind of nothing going on.
Those are two different things. I mean, what you just said is two different things. Okay. So clear and stable and nothing going on.
Okay, right. Right.
So I just sort of clarify that. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going to jump in.
So I guess the question is that, because I remember in specifically one talk, I believe maybe it was Lompo Liam, I'm not quite remembering, but it wasn't easy, you know, that a thought of aversion or anger could come up in the mind, But his response to it was just to not pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess trying to sort of reconcile these two, sort of like there's a inclination to think that as practice goes farther, that these thoughts or these things sort of stop or they reduce or there's a reduction. Then there's also this sort of recognition of not picking these things up when they do come up. So I kind of...
Well, I think what happens is when it's seen clearly, then they tend to... of course, they don't have this the same power over the mind, so the mind doesn't proliferate around it, doesn't move with it. And as one increasingly sees things clearly, then the mind doesn't incline to picking it up because it's seen so readily, so quickly, so thoroughly. But it doesn't mean there's not contact, or there's not movement, or there's not or there's not even opinions and views. But it's not taking a stand on them, it's not picking them up, it's not holding them and then moving with them further, because one's seeing every time, every single time it leads to suffering. So that is penetrating. But it doesn't mean there's nothing happening. It's like the story of with Ajahn Chah, where palmist astrologer was at Wat Pa Phong and then asked to look at Ajahn Chah's hands because he was sort of fascinated with them. And he was a well-known kind of astrologer slash palmist. And he started looking at Ajahn Chah's hands and sort of looking at his hands. So according to your lines in your hand, you've got a lot of anger. And Ajahn Chah sort of laughed. He said, yeah, but I don't take it. I don't mean that I am. Sort of, yeah, I have, but I don't pick it up. So there's a propensity, and then, that also formulates a certain character trait, even for somebody who is liberated. They're somebody who has a background of a propensity to anger as a temperament, they'll manifest differently. Ajahn Chah was very quick, very mercurial. That's part of the way that somebody with that, because an aversion temperament is one that is quick, very sharp, very discerning.
So if that's the case, is the Bonpocha more into the humor, more to take over the anger? Is there anything to counter it? I mean,
I don't know. I think he was always, even as a young boy growing up, or as a young man growing up, he was always kind of the center of attention, storyteller. Everybody wanted to be close to him because he always had that ebullient character was there even as a lay person. So I think it's more just his character showing through. And it was actually interesting when Ajahn Chah's mother died, And we were doing preparations for this mother's funeral, and then his older brother came to the monastery every day. He was staying. He didn't live nearby. He lived quite a ways away, but he came and stayed in the village and came every day for the preparations. And it was like this lay version of Ajahn Chah. Everybody, as just is, then we're working on these baskets. We're weaving these large bamboo baskets, and there's a bunch of people around. But everybody was clustered around him because he was telling stories, and everybody was laughing. And it was just a family trait.
That kind of seems to highlight something tangentially as well, is that, like Ajahn Chah's older brother, not having feelings of inferiority because his younger brother's this famous monk or anything, but he just goes, he's plugging in, telling stories.
So, oh, totally.
I think for us, we tend to have the tendency, like, oh, my relatives, I'm inferior, comparing, like, some more of that sense of comparing.
Yeah, that was never the case.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. Perspective.
Yeah, I appreciate the part farming on non-stick, and yeah. I like that a lot. It's hard to do, and I think, you know, for me, looking in that term of non-sticking, and it's accessible, it's possible.
Yes.
But if you talk about nirvana, somewhere up there, I give up. You know, it seems like it's too much.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Well, it's also, it's kind of, idealized and kind of rarefied, and I think the reality, I think that's where it's really helpful to have a practice tradition where people do experience this, and then they're able to relate it, and it's passed on. and having different characteristics, like Meijin Gel, not really being an articulate teacher, but still being a wonderful example, being able to point where he should. There's always, up until she died, there was this constant stream of people going and visiting and paying respects, and even if she never said anything. And then even if she did say something, it was in Putai, which nobody can understand that. So there's an obscure dialect of the Isan.
There's also, I remember going to Ajahn Manso village, because it's quite close to Bujangong, and I went for a teo one day, I met Ajahn Man's nephew. And he looked very similar to Ajahn Man. It was quite strange. Yeah, just talking to him, I asked him when was Ajahn Man born, and we went to the place where there's a birth monument, and then I said, how many houses were in this village when Ajahn Man was growing up? He said, 8. In the middle of the jungle.
Yeah, but it's also, it's sort of like, it's still within living memory.
Right.
Yeah.
The distinction you made between having a clear and stable mind versus having a mind that just doesn't have anything going on. And I was thinking about the Lumpur Chop, making that distinction a lot. Like you can have a mind that's like a peaceful mind, but then the mind that's appeased the kilesa, or the kilesa, and so that can be thought of as like, okay, you might have samadhi, but you're just kind of oppressing or suppressing the hindrances temporarily. Like it can kind of have that feel, but he talks about it so much and with different terms that. Is that a good skill just to have in general, like to, even if there are like kilesa coming up, to be able to have peace around it. Like if you've got anger, but not to make a problem out of it.
Because the thing is as soon as you, even if you're in a full blown kilesa mode, to be able to acknowledge it and sort of, this is painful. This is uncomfortable. Whereas, there's a problem with the kilesas, but then there's a problem with delusion where we complicate that even more, or we try to paint it into, make it into something else, to find justifications for it.
So on that topic you just brought up, it seems that experience with these defilements, it seems so rare that it's like greed. It's almost like greed, hatred, delusion, and it's kind of wrapping around each other in cycles.
Yes.
I remember reading Meiji Gao's book, this book, and the quote about being honest, if you're lying, you lie to the whole world, but make sure that you're honest yourself. And it's just, I don't know, there's something about that was so helpful to see it there. Like these, these kind of defilements wrapping around these defilements you're trying to work with.
Yeah, I know that's it. It is a big component, actually, in making progress, is that? Just being really honest and clear, there's so much self involved in the Western psyche sometimes. But yeah, I'm really honest with myself. I'm just completely hopeless, pathetic. Man, I'm really honest. but that's not really that helpful. It's not really honest in that sense. So that sense of being able to stand back and okay, what's the value here?
Are there any kind of recommendations for any practices around this outfit? I mean, like, I guess it's just sort of seeing this so much in this kind of sheet, there's so much delusion here, and sometimes, that's not always the case, but it's just, learning how to work with this in a practical sense.
In a practical sense, I mean, part of it is one is having a sense of humor. You can't take yourself too seriously. That's really deadly. And then also in terms of working with things that, rather than, because when you look at greed, hate, delusion, and all the defilements that are possible, there's a lot. But if one looks at, what's the experience right now? Well, how do I work with it? How do I deal with it? Okay, there's this particular aversion that's happening, or this particular sort of attraction that's pulling, okay? It's just sort of one at a time, it's just sort of, that's what reminds me of that, when I was the abbot at One Man a Child, and then while the monks were on Aldrin, the lay guest would stay and sweep the grounds, the central area, and the trails that were in there, and
there's this one lay person who'd been there for a while, and then a new person came out in the morning, and he just arrived, and he comes out, and he lined this up, and the layman who'd been there, he's already sweeping, and this other layman comes out, and he sort of looks, oh, do we have to sweep all this? And the other layman, no, just sweep what's in front of your broom. You know, and it's similar, you know, oh, do we have to deal with all these defilements? No, just the one that's coming up right now, and it's working with that.